Welcome to the Seven Figure Fundraising Podcast, the podcast where we discuss specific tactics and strategies to grow your nonprofit. I'm your host, Trevor Bragdon. Well, thanks for being on the show, Chelsea. Really appreciate having you. I just want to go through a quick bio just to give our listeners a little background. Chelsea is the founder and executive director of the Motherhood Advocacy Project, formerly known as the Foster Care Alliance. After growing up in Atlanta, Chelsea attended Stanford University, where she received a bachelor's degree in communication studies with a minor in writing. After fostering in Atlanta for 3 years, Chelsea became passionate about more than just helping children in need. She had a desire to help the whole family. As a single mom herself, it's become her mission to help other moms overcome life's challenges in order to keep their families together and out of foster care. Thanks for being on the show, Chelsea, and really excited to talk to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So to start out, can you tell us a little bit more about what the Motherhood Advocacy Project is and how it got started?
So Mothers Advocacy Project is a nonprofit here in Atlanta, Georgia, and it started out just through my own personal story of fostering. It started as the Foster Care Alliance, where we were working with single birth moms of children who were in foster care. And then as it's expanded over the years and grown and changed, we decided to change the name to Mothers Advocacy Project. And the reason we did that was to be able to be something, a place where moms could really be proud of the program that they were in. And after hearing some great feedback from clients and alumni, we decided to make that change. What we do is not just a band-aid that we put on to check boxes and get kids back home, but what we do is really working on healing of mom. The basis of everything is trauma intervention. And so when mom comes into our program, she does a battery of different assessments. We determine where she is. 98% of moms that come to us have complex PTSD and trauma. And we take those assessments and we put together a plan for them of healing. It goes through a three-phase approach. The first phase is resetting the central nervous system, helping them understand their trauma, helping them understand triggers that come from their trauma, and realizing that it wasn't their fault. The second phase is helping them to then unpack the trauma that they had individually. So what was their story? What actually happened? And being able to start to understand how that's affected their life and be able to come to a place of healing from that. And phase three is the assimilation phase. It's when they begin to give back. It's when they start to see that although trauma was a senseless event in their life, that they now get to make some sense of it, that they're not just survivors, but that they're thriving beyond that and that they can help others who have also gone through it. This was really something that was a dream for me when I was fostering my now adopted son and realized all of the stories and the journey that had gotten his family to the place where he was in foster care. And I realized quickly that it wasn't because they didn't love him, but it was because of past trauma that really hindered them from being able to have a healthy and stable life.
So how did you go about starting this? Like, you have a really developed and well-running nonprofit now, but how did this come about with that initial fostering of the child who now became your son that you've adopted? But can you talk to us about how you founded it and how that started, kind of that germ of an idea?
Sure, absolutely. So for me, it was one where I had been coaching other nonprofits and startups for years. I had worked in churches, helping nonprofits in the area get to healthy places. I had volunteered. I had always been passionate about children in poverty and families in poverty and helping them get out. And so as I was fostering, I started to ask a lot of questions about why things were being done the way that they were being done, why I wasn't seeing genuine healing, why I wasn't seeing services being provided in the way that was necessary for my son's birth mother. And as I was asking these questions, it really became something for me where it was the first time in my life that it was a problem that I felt like I had to solve or die trying. Most of the time, I And really all the time in my life prior to that, I was very, very content helping other people start their dreams and helping coach them in that. I was always in a support role and really enjoyed it, was very content. I never thought I would start my own business. I thought maybe someday I'd be executive director of, as I got more seasoned, of a nonprofit somebody else started years and years ago, but never thought I'd have something that I was so passionate about that I couldn't sleep at night until I figured it out. And so honestly, I started to think about the idea, started to ask questions and really start to pray about whether or not this was something that that I was going to start now or start later. It was never really a question of whether I was going to do it. It was just, am I ready now? So I decided, I had a townhouse. I was renting in the city of Atlanta at the time, but I had a townhouse that I owned up in the suburbs. And I decided, okay, I'm just going to try to sell it and see what happens. And if I sell it for a certain amount, then I will quit my job and I will take the first year researching best practices across the country and try to figure out what I want to, how I want to start it, what I want to start, and what our model should be. And so I put my house on the market. 3 days later, I was under contract and the profit, somebody offered me cash for three times what I wanted as a profit. Needless to say, I was able then to say, okay, I can go without a salary for a year. So I went to my boss and I said, hey, I've got this idea, something I want to start. And he stopped me and he said, I know. And he said, actually, my wife came to me the other day. She was praying for you. And she told me that God told her that you had an idea that God was birthing in you and that I was to support and encourage and send you off in that. And so that was even more confirmation for me. So I finished out my job. I didn't leave for probably 3 or 4 months just to finish out well, and then ended up leaving. I took an entire year to research best practices and to interview people who had started nonprofits, people who had run successful companies, entrepreneurs, and people who I really just trusted and respected. One man who I spoke with, his name is John. He was probably in his late 70s at the time, and he was in the military for years and years. And I always respected what he had to say. He'd coached me in a lot of things over the time when it came to nonprofits and was really great at finances. And his greatest advice to me was, don't just have a plan A and a plan B, but have a plan C, so that you're never caught off guard. And then he told me to ask as many different people about my idea, my project as possible, and tell them that I wouldn't be offended, shoot as many holes in it so that I have a chance to be able to make a plan B and a plan C were those holes to actually be a problem. And so I did that. And for that first year, really just started at the drawing board of figuring out and asking people to shoot holes in my idea and figure out the best way to go forward.
That's awesome. And so just stepping back, just so people don't miss this, you sold your condo and then lived off the proceeds. Like, you didn't fundraise, you lived off your own money to start this nonprofit.
I did.
Did anyone think you were crazy, or what was the feedback from like friends and family?
100%. They thought I was crazy. But at the same time, I cared about it. I was passionate about it. And I think it's the fact that it was so personal to me and the fact that his birth mom will always be like family to me. And being able to see that, see her face as I was doing that and see my son's face. And I will be honest, adoption is really beautiful, but it's also really difficult. It's not tied up with a bow like people think. And so I think another thing that really drove me in that was, I want my son, when he grows up, to be able to be proud of how I treated his mom, his birth mom, and proud of the way that I lived my life trying to help other children and families that were in the situation he was in. And so I felt like I had to do it. And I was really blessed that God didn't cause me to struggle in that way, but it was important to me. The other thing I think that's interesting to note about it is just that God did provide. And that he did give me beyond what I needed. And it was a tight year. And, you know, without income coming in, everything was budgeted really tight, but we never missed a bill. And now on this end, we're doing okay. I will say I did keep track throughout that year of all my business expenses so that I could reimburse myself. But 4 years later, That's never happened. So right. I'm counting it as an investment.
Right. Your own gift to the organization sort of thing.
Exactly.
Right.
With no tax write-off.
Yeah, exactly. So take me through. So what did you learn that first year that helped you set up for the success you've had since then? You talked about like having a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C and going through that process. But what did you learn? And then how did that set you up? And then would you recommend other nonprofit people looking to found nonprofits follow a similar process where they kind of deep dive first before starting?
Yeah, absolutely. So I found out a lot of things. I interviewed people across the country, Alaska, Iowa, Arkansas, California, New York, North Carolina, different organizations that were doing something that I was interested in. And what I found was pieces that I really loved and resonated with me. And then I found pieces that really weren't as research-based. So maybe they felt good on the outside, but they weren't proven yet. And so honestly, I was able to put together some semblance of order in terms of what could actually be a really great intervention rather than just copying something. So that was really helpful to me. I will say also, I learned that as I shared my story, that I wasn't so alone in starting this, that I had a lot of people that were excited about me taking this to the next step, that fostering was something people supported me in, but then even watching this and hearing my story and why I wanted to start it, and even people who had no experience with foster care really wanted to help me. It also built up a base of donors and supporters who saw that I was committed to it, but had an invested interest because they had sat down and given their advice on it. So it really felt like what a nonprofit should be, a community organization that was created by the community. And so I would say that that was something that was really valuable. I will also say, as a founder, we talk a lot about founderitis and being so married to your idea that you can't shift and change. Starting off this way creates the ability and the necessity, really, to be humble about your idea and to recognize that you've been given a vision, but that's only a piece of it. And other people have wisdom that can be spoken into it. And so that humility has honestly given us a place where I have the ability now to hear critique and actually make changes as necessary, which I would say is why to this day we've been able to make major changes and pivots, even such as changing our name, because we heard from clients and alumni and advisors that Foster Care Alliance wasn't a positive reflection of what we actually do. And so I wasn't, although that was difficult because that was my baby, it was also, okay, that name got us launched, but if it's not best, then we already had this culture of needing plan B and plan C to make it the best that it could be.
That's so great. And I think it's really interesting, like instead of, you know, they talk about with startups, like sometimes people go into stealth mode, you know, where they're working on their project, not talking to anyone, and then they have the big reveal. And obviously it's a little different with nonprofits, but it's interesting how you kind of built this base of donors that you later, after talking with them, getting their advice, that you went back to. So they've been able to see this journey with you and experience it firsthand. That's really interesting because it's kind of counterintuitive than what you'd expect.
It was. And I also think, you know, it's positive when they see that you're also making an investment as well, that I'm not starting this nonprofit because I don't feel like working somewhere and just getting an easy paycheck, that I want to raise money so people just give me money. But they see that I'm actually invested and I'm in this for the long haul and I'm willing to really stake my livelihood on it, that it's going to be successful, I think really built a base of people who believed in what we were going to do.
Right. And you had so much skin in the game where you're living on your own money to make this happen and make this a reality. So take us through, you did this year of research, and then what happened next?
So we opened up, we decided to launch, we got a building, which was falling apart. Literally, the gutters and the part of the roof on the front were falling down to the point we had to prop it up so that it wasn't a liability. I mean, old, old building. But my church came in, we pulled up carpet, we painted walls, we did everything we could to make this great. And we launched. And quite honestly, Trevor, we didn't have one referral for 3 months.
Oh my gosh.
So we had done all this research. We had this great, DFACS was even, the Department of Family and Children Services, was on board. They liked the idea. zero referrals for 3 months. And I was like, okay. And so we took that time to just continue building. At the time, I had 2 employees that I'd hired, someone to kind of run operations in the front office and somebody who was our case manager. And then I had a contracted therapist and we didn't have anybody. And then we decided we'd do an employment workshop, which was something totally different than we were expecting, but it was a way to get people in the door. So we got 5 people to sign up for it and we started working with them and it was great. But I had things I wanted to try, right? I had different models. I had, oh, let's try to do this, let's try to do that. And we did it and it worked. I mean, people were, they were happy with it, but it wasn't really a model that was replicable. It was so individualized. But it was really a learning and growing process of us being able to take all that we learned and then try some things out. We still keep in touch with those families to this day, but they did not go through all 3 phases because we didn't even have 3 phases at that point. So really it was take the research and just start. You're never going to be completely ready. Sometimes you just have to start and try. And when people ask, I always say, we tweak and change and tweak and change and tweak and change constantly until you get to something. And I think if you want to be relevant and if you want to be cutting edge on best research and best practices, you're really always tweaking and changing, sometimes more than others. So in the beginning, we had to really tweak and change. And then quite honestly, we found in the first 6 months, somebody was kind of questioning what we were doing and what our practices were, and everybody was looking into us, and DFACS got wind of who we were and that sort of thing. And we had somebody that actually got in trouble for giving us a bunch of psychological information and things without having a proper agreement. And so we were temporarily shut down for about 2 months. We had no idea about those types of agreements. We expected the person we were working with to tell us about this. That person is no longer with the department for several reasons, not just this. But come to find out that for those couple months, we had to stop seeing all of our clients and just pause for a few months. They told us not to talk to our clients, not to do anything like that. We pushed back and we said, well, even if you shut us down forever, we're going to tell our clients face to face and we are going to refer them to other providers because we want their interventions to continue. And so we did that. We used integrity. DFACS then looked into us. We gave them all of our financials, everything, let them look at it. They ended up coming back after those 2 months and saying, we've never seen a nonprofit that was so detailed and whose books were so clean and whose records of clients and release forms and everything were so detailed that they said, where do you want to go? What counties? And so we grew after that 2 months from 1 county to 4 counties. What we thought was shutting down was actually a catalyst for growth. And we ended up becoming now not just known by county level people in 1 county, but by the entire state level organization after being looked into. And they're constantly trying to get us to go to more places. So I would say starting for us was not sunshine and butterflies and flowers. It was a really tough first year, but people stuck with us because they knew the integrity of the organization and they knew we'd pull through. I can't say I was as optimistic in that moment as everyone else. I was nervous, but at the end of the day, doing integrity in the small things when nobody's looking ended up really paying off for us in the long run, because when they did look, we had everything together.
Right. And how did you keep your staff motivated? You know, you said a full-time therapist working for you and you have 90 days in this first year without a client, and then you have 2 months you're shut down. Like, imagine you probably wanted to be with meet with the therapist yourself after, such a probably ups did. And downs. But like, what did you do as a leader to keep your team motivated where probably wasn't looking that great in the short term?
Yeah, so it was tough, but I would say the people that I hired had a passion for this work. They weren't hired for a job, but they believed in what we were doing. And really, it was keeping that vision at the forefront. One of the books that I've been reading currently that I think actually speaks to this a little bit is a book on rituals in the workplace, and been doing a lot of that in terms of culture with our staff this year. But one of the points that it makes that I love is this idea of your employees need to see the vision, but the vision needs to be connected with their own values. And when it's connected to their own values, then they'll stick with it. And I think that's what I really saw was my staff, their values of wanting to invest in these families and cause them to have a deeper belief in the vision. In addition to that, I again had to model what it looked like to make some sacrifice. And so my staff remained paid, but I did not. And I actually let them know that so that they would know that this was something that I was for them and I wanted their families to do well and all of that. And we weathered the storm without losing any of our staff at that point.
Wow, that's great. And I imagine like coming through the other side of that, you probably felt like you could kind of survive anything if you'd had that sort of first year.
Yes. And I will say, you know, there were two very significant donors during that time that came behind us and said, you know, whether you go down, whether you go under or not, we're going under with you. And we're willing to invest to at least keep you afloat. But we cut everything that we didn't have to. I mean, as silly as it sounds, we paid $8 a month for Crystal water bottle to come in our, we returned the machine, got the refund. We didn't do the $8. Keeping our temperature as best we could, we were bare minimum, anything we could cut, we did. And honestly, it probably took me almost a year after that, like you were saying, weather the storm. We weathered the storm. We felt like we could do anything, but at the same time, we were still, I didn't bring the water back for a while, like just this anxiety of what if something like this happens again? And I will say that that experience has probably made us tighter on our budget and probably will always continue in the back of my mind of if we need to go dark for a little bit or we need to cut back, it's not as hard as it was in the beginning. We sold a ton of furniture. We had a garage sale at somebody's house, offered to do host one. We took all the stuff over there. We sold furniture. We sold notebooks. We sold anything we could. We made about $1,200, but it kept us going. It was like we were just doing anything we could. And honestly, that mentality is probably what kept us going through COVID because we knew how to go lean when we had to.
Right. That's great. Wow. The thought of like selling your furniture to keep the lights on is just, I think, shows the commitment you and your team had, like all on the same page, all working to the same goal.
For sure. And garage sales are just not fun.
Yeah.
So my
I don't like
plus
them.
My team, yeah. It was like we were out there in the hot sun in Atlanta selling furniture, delivering furniture in our own cars to people, posting on any social media for anyone that would purchase it. But we had a reason, we had a goal. And at the end of it, we all said, we're never doing this again. And we all went out and got coffee and ice cream. But we did it. And it was a bonding experience for us too as a team.
Right. Well, there's that saying, I think it's Reid Hoffman. He talks about the founder of LinkedIn, how building a startup is like putting together the plane while you're free falling. And I think
100%.
Yeah,
yes.
I can see the correlation here. So take us through, you've gone through this first kind of rocky, you had the year of research, this kind of rocky first year that turns out well because you guys had done a good job, even though you were questioned and you had this period where you're shut down and it still turns into a good thing. What's it like for the clients that come through? Can you walk us through what their experience is like? Maybe it's more now since you've evolved, but just what's the service like for them?
Sure. So when we got the green light to go ahead and reopen, I sat down with our therapist at the time in a Caribou Coffee, and we sat there for hours and we said, okay, we've got another shot. How many nonprofits get another shot? We can take everything we've learned over the last 6 months to 8 months and we can relaunch, basically. And so she started putting together all these research articles and came to me and said, this is what I want to do. And she'd been working for 20 years in the field of trauma intervention and with families who were survivors of trauma. So she was very experienced in this, knew a lot. And so really, she said, all the research I've been doing is saying, let's not put them in individual therapy for trauma. We need to have this phase one, this what we called at the time, the STEP program. And it was social support, trauma intervention, education, and participatory arts. And that was what STEP stood for. And she said, I'm reading all this stuff about martial arts and dance and yoga and how it works the same part of your brain that trauma therapy does. And if you do it at the same time, it actually expedites the therapeutic process. So we said, okay, great. So we had a partner, somebody that we knew and trusted. We partnered with them and said, will you do the martial arts and we're going to do the therapy? We wrote a manual with psychoeducation, different types of things that they needed to know. She wrote what the 12 weeks would look like for this resetting of the brain. And then all the research we found said that it had to be done in a group. So we said, all right, we're going to do this. It made us unique because nobody was doing this type of pre-trauma intervention. And what we were finding is that in actual trauma intervention, if I were to bring you into therapy and you're going to talk about your trauma, but I've never talked to you about the triggers or how to de-escalate yourself, then you could come, you could do therapy and be triggered, leave, and then harm yourself or another because you just had a really hard session.
Oh, interesting.
And so what all the research was saying was we actually have to have something in the beginning where we're making sure that people know how to regulate their emotions, how to recognize their triggers, and how to communicate to other people. This is a trigger for me. I'm feeling triggered right now. I need a minute, and how to de-escalate themselves. So we decided to try this and get people to come in. And so we, again, partnered with DFACS. We started bringing in some moms, doing this group intervention, and it was going wonderfully. And so for a year, we did the STEP program. And then when they finished step one, or that step, phase one, they were ready for individual therapy, but we didn't have the staff or the means to really be able to do it. So we would refer them to other individual therapists in the community. However, what we found was that none of them actually went to the individual therapist. So we taught them about all these things, but then they never actually got to their trauma intervention. And they kept asking us if we would do it, if we would do it, because we knew their stories and we knew them so deeply. And we had done basically a full psychological assessment with them. And we'd pass all this information to the therapist and this sort of thing, but they didn't want to tell their story again. They didn't want to have to trust one more person because trust is something that doesn't come easily for this population. And so we decided, we had planned actually after that 1 year of STEP to open another site. And we said, we're going to take more families. We're going to open another site. And so we had communicated that we were ready to go. We were going to all these counties and we sat down and we said, okay, is this what we want to do? Because business move wise, we should probably start more sites because donors really like to see that. However, our moms are needing more and we know that they're needing more. So would we rather grow by opening another site like we've been saying, or would we rather grow by adding more phases and writing more material? And so we said, okay, it's going to be more work for us, but we're going to do it. And so we decided after that year to add phase two and phase three, where we actually do individual therapy. And then that phase three, like I was mentioning before, where they go back into a support group to assimilate that trauma. And so we decided to do that and kept moving along in those phases and things were going really, really well with that. And so we planned to continue doing that into last year. And then of course, COVID. And so we didn't quite get as many families through as we hoped in that next year, but we at least had the three phases. And so during COVID, we said the same thing. We planned in 2021 to open another site and to be doing the three phases at another site. But with COVID, we had to take less people to be able to socially distance them in a room. We had to, you know, we were still doing childcare and that sort of thing. And so we looked at it and we said, okay, our clients have been asking us forever to do child trauma therapy with their children. That's not on the plan for another 5 years. However, we won't have to cross-contaminate as many families if we take less moms, but we actually add the program to help children. And so we decided yet again for 2021 that we would just go deeper rather than wider.
By cross-contamination, you mean like with COVID itself?
Yes, exactly. Because we had to keep families so separate. If we had two families there for childcare, we had to have different people watching them because it was so strict at the beginning. And we had to distance our moms in group and all of this. And so we had to make sure we weren't mixing families. And now it's not quite as big of a deal because they'll wear masks and we do, you know, all of the safety protocols and kids are back in school and such here in Georgia. But all that to say, we just had to be careful. So we decided to pilot that program at the end of 2020 to see if we wanted to go with it in 2021. And the pilot program, our final results will be back in a couple of weeks. But the preliminary data is looking really, really good. Our families are very happy. We're seeing behaviors go down. We're seeing family stability and the issues, behaviors and emotional issues at home are so much better, grades improving, seeing so many great outcomes, which takes the stress off mom. And so really what we thought we'd do with our original strategic plan was that we'd grow bigger. And what we've actually done because of so many different bumps in the road is the plan C, really, which is, okay, almost going backwards of our strategic plan and going deeper first before we actually expand bigger. So the plan is next year to finally open another site, but who knows, maybe I'll decide to add another program first.
Right. Well, but you're still meeting the goals of your strategic plans, just in a different order than you'd expected.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's so great. So I'm just curious, like just going back a little bit to your interventions and how you do this with your clients, is the Marsh, so basically it's you do group therapy with your clients, then individual therapy, and then go back to the group.
Correct.
Correct. So like you get kind of broader skills in the group setting to begin with, then you work on the specific issues and work through the trauma that they've dealt on a personal level, and then go back to the group and apply both together. The martial arts component, what do you think is the reason that's so successful with your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. So martial arts happens in phase one. So they're doing it as a group. And so it does a lot for the brain. So when you're having to learn different poses, movements, small body motions, and you're having to concentrate on being able to do them correctly, properly, not injure yourself, all of these things, right? You're having to really take your brain away from what you may always be dwelling upon and focus on something else. That is the type of therapy that we do, is where it's more than just a talk therapy where you're just talking, but we're teaching very specific skills. It is the same part of your brain that has worked when you're learning therapeutic skills and psychoeducation about how to de-escalate and how to emotion regulate and identifying triggers. It's the same part of your brain as will be used in martial arts. And so it's similar to if you were exercising and you were to do cardio and then you do a leg day, but then you're still doing cardio by running, you're still working the same muscles just in a different way. And so it's the same part of the brain that's working. And that's why it helps to expedite the process so well. In addition to that, our martial arts provider pulls our women aside and works with them on different techniques of self-defense. Many of our moms have been physically and sexually abused, and in the communities that they live in, every one of our moms carries a weapon because she's scared of what may happen in the community that she's in and don't feel safe. And so for us, the martial arts also has added that component of them feeling really, really safe. The last thing I'll say that's interesting is when you're a trauma survivor, you often see your body in a very negative way because you see your body as you blame it, that's the reason why this person abused me and that my body felt the pain. And so my body is now negative to me, which is why you often see with trauma survivors, different types of self-harm or even overeating or not caring about what your body looks like or super obsessive about what you look like and not eating or harming yourself in some way. And so we see that as very, very common with trauma survivors. When you are doing things like yoga, dance, martial arts, you are starting to recognize that your body is strong and capable of doing more than you ever thought it could do. And you start to feel your body in a way that's this mind-body connection. You start to feel your body as a strong physical presence that can overcome something, but that also can be taken care of and can be tweaked and changed in order to serve you better. And so it's a really cool connection that way where we do that. One great example is We had a mom one time who was there, and she was just struggled with depression and so many things. And at martial arts one day, she just started laughing. And we were like, what in the world? And could not stop laughing. And it was this physical release of joy that she afterwards said, like, I don't remember the last time I laughed or smiled, but it was something that was, she was successful at something, even if it was a small motion. And she had mastered it, and she was so proud of herself that she was overcome with joy. And so it's also a sense of we're giving our moms this ability to make small progressions, when in life, it's much harder. The jumps and the progressions are much bigger, but being able to master a movement allows you to feel like you're making progress and allows you to feel like your body has the ability to continue making bigger progress in the future of your life.
Right. Well, and that makes a ton of sense. Like, you're feeling more confident, you're feeling better about yourself. And then when you go into the individual work, which I'm sure is much more difficult, likely, you already have this baseline of you've added new skills, you're feeling better about your physical safety, your ability to take care of yourself and protect yourself. It's really yes. fascinating. Yes. So is this all came from, like, the design came, though, from that, like, year of research and working with your team on coming up with how to specifically do this?
Yes. So our lead psychotherapist really wrote the majority of the trauma intervention that goes along with it. And again, it came from all that time of research and research studies. So every component that we have a big, thick binder of research studies, and it keeps growing and we keep adding binders. But every component that we have, even down to how we train our staff to follow up on intake and the questions we ask and these types of things, all have a research study to go behind them.
That's really great. So what have your outcomes been? Like, I know it's still early and you've had still a limited number of people go through your program, but what have the early initial outcomes been?
Yeah. So our outcomes have really been great. We have found over time, as I mentioned, when we changed our name, we started with reunification readiness, but then we started taking moms who are what is called family preservation. And so when we took family preservation mothers, this was moms who still had the kids in their custody, but were at risk of coming into foster care due to some sort of issue. And we found through that 84% of kids that come into foster care come in for solvable problems. So family preservation is saying, could we solve these problems before we ever bring them into care? But then we saw this funny phenomenon happening that doesn't usually happen with service providers, is that our moms started telling their friends and their relatives and their neighbors about our program. And so we started having self-referrals from the community. So we opened up even more to that. One example is we had a mom, we had no idea she did this, but she learned something in therapy that was really helpful to her. She posted about it on Facebook, and we woke up the next morning to 23 referrals and 40 over the course of that week.
Wow.
Of people saying, a friend of a friend saw this post, and I heard that your program helps single moms in need. I have trauma, I need help. And so we saw this influx of people. So with that said, we have had really, really great success when it comes to family preservation in terms of kids not coming in to foster care. And so with that, of all the moms that have gone through that are our family preservation cases, we've had one child who has gone into care, and there were three children in that home. And that was because she's a baby and there was some laundry detergent she accidentally got into. And so they had to investigate. They investigated it and the child was returned back home. So even in that situation, 100% of the moms that have gone through our program, we have been able to avoid going into foster care. So what we're really hoping in the future is we're pivoting a bit in that way. And we're saying, let us work with these families before you bring their children into care. If you think that it's a solvable issue that's putting the child at risk, help us make that referral and let us help them stabilize the family, and you won't see them come into care. The moms that have gone through the phases, every mom that completes phase 1, 2, and 3 are stably employed, stably housed, financially stable, emotionally stable, kids are going to school. They are really, really thriving. In fact, the majority of them have even received raises and promotions in their jobs since graduating. One in particular that I'm really proud of is actually now currently a full-time member of our staff, working with alumni and working with new families and doing a lot. And having someone who graduated from our program on our staff has been invaluable to us in terms of just being able to help us grow, but also showing that it doesn't just work to the point where I'm willing to close a case, but it works to the point where I'm willing, not only willing, but seeking out these women to come back on our staff. If I had more positions available, there are more women that I would want to bring on our staff to come back and help.
That's so great. And like, if you think about it, like, who's a better messenger than someone who's been through the program, understands the world these people, these women have been in. But it also makes sense too. Like, if you have this trauma in your past, like, you deal with that every day. And if you can help address that and have ways to, you can't erase the past, but be able to work with it, and you help fix that, then you have great opportunities to, you know, better your life in other ways, like you said, with jobs and these different things. So it's really interesting kind of,
yes,
by addressing that, what ripple effects it has in these lives.
Yes. One of the assessments that I love that we've added just recently to the end, so I don't have great data on it now, but we will, but it's a great assessment on quality of life and enjoyment. And I'm excited to be able to see that, to see from when they start in our program to when they end, what do they see as their quality of life? Are they enjoying life? Are they more satisfied with life? And I think that's a really significant indicator of where they're at, but also a really significant driver for us that it's, again, not checking boxes. Like everybody says, they've done the therapy, they've done this, the assessment looks better, but also, do they feel like they're stronger and better? And do they feel more confident as mothers in our community?
That's so great. Well, I want to shift gears just a little bit. And it's really just been fascinating learning, you know, this crazy journey you've been on. I just want to talk a little bit about fundraising and what that experience has been like. Because we've talked about the program side and that whole part of it and all the difficulties there. But how has the fundraising been? Like, what was it like asking for your first gift as you were building this organization? As you were doing this year of research, when did that first donation ask happen, and what was that like?
Yeah, so I would think, I would say that fundraising is always seen as a challenge for nonprofits because it's what keeps you existing. However, I think that what I've learned is that vulnerability with donors and inviting them into the story is so significant. So that first year of research and allowing people to speak into it and to know the journey that I was on made it much easier. In addition to that, I will say that there will always be a handful of families that will be very, very special to our work because they were the ones that believed in it before they even knew if it was going to work. And as much as I don't want to have the organization tied to me, when you're starting something, it is people who believe in you, which is really humbling and maybe gives you a little bit more drive to succeed because people are counting on you and believing in you. But I would say that those first asks were, I wouldn't even say that they were difficult because I knew the people I was asking and I knew that they believed in what I was doing. If you're starting something, the best thing to do is to really start with your inner circle and start with family, friends, and people that you know, even if they're giving small amounts, because they want to give to you and believe in you. But also having a really realistic expectation of how much you can raise in the first few years. I've heard a lot of people have said to me, and I always just laugh, but have said, oh, well, if I just started a nonprofit, there's so many grants out there, I could make millions. And I'm like, mm-hmm.
Right.
And you have to recognize that you might apply for 50 grants and get two.
Right.
And they may not even be the amount you applied for. And before your first 3 years, you will likely get zero grants. It will all be personal relationships, and it'll be people who are interested in the story and interested, quite honestly, in the personal story of what it was. I'm really careful not to use my son as a form of marketing for the organization. His face is never going to be on anything. I'm never going to say his name. I want him to be able to just be my son and not feel like he's the face of an organization and that I'm using him in order to make money for the organization. However, you don't even have to think about it that way when it's people who know you and know your story and have been with you, because they know, they understand your heart behind the organization, and it gives a chance for them to really just support me and what I felt like God was calling me to do.
That's such a great point. And I think a couple of interesting things you just brought up, like the whole thing that donors invest in you. You know, they like the idea of what you're planning to do, but they're really investing in you because they know you're going to have to figure it out, which, you know, you did for 2 years, right? To get the plans. But on the other side, like on the foundation front, they don't invest in people figuring it out typically, because that's not their job. Their job is to fund things that work, are proven, and help them scale or help them reach other communities or open the second center. For people trying to start nonprofits, understanding that and realizing it's the individuals who will invest in you and believe in your dream and your vision and help make it possible. I think that's such an important point.
Yes. And I think, and what you're saying about the foundations is so true, that you can't find it frustrating when they don't. But I also think that it's tempting in the beginning to chase money and to recognize, okay, well, this is the intervention I like, but if I added this that's evidence-based, then there's money for this, so I might be able to do it. And having to stay really true to what you're starting and why you're starting it. But it takes a lot of planning and prepping. If I had thought about starting an organization and did not prep financially for my family beforehand, this would have been much, much harder. And I would have had to quit out of necessity to be able to support my family. There's something to that of needing to know that you're not going to get grants right off the bat, and that you're probably not going to have the salary that's equal to what I was making at the other job in the first couple of years even. And so with that said, I think it takes a lot of personal planning and family planning as well to determine what does your family need, and are you ready to make that leap? Because people will invest in you for sure, but you're going to have to be able to prove it in a couple of years. And so are you really ready to dive all in?
Right. That's such an important point. And I had this business guy who had built several companies once told me, he's like, all startups take 3 to 5 years to be successful. It's like, no one ever tells you that because you never would start. But it takes 3 to 5 years to really find your stride, find your product market fit, you know, or your service market fit. And like knowing, like, can your family handle it? Is this something where if we don't take a paycheck for several months, is this something we can do? I think that's really important that everyone's on board and everyone understands.
Yes. There was my company I worked for called Plywood People, Jeff Schoenebarger. He does great work, but he always says, he and his wife say, if we save the world, but we lose our family, then we lose. And for me, that was where that planning came, is I could change foster care and flip it upside down. But if at the end of the day, I was never there for my son and he ends up resenting the work that I did, or ends up being scarred himself because he never had a mom that was involved in his life, then did I really do what was my primary responsibility? And so I think there's a lot of great ideas, but I think timing is everything too.
Right. And that's, yeah, I think that's and it's easy to go into the feedback loop of I work more than I get feedback from your donors, the people, you know, you get that instant feedback, whereas your family, the feedback might not be for a decade or 25 years or whatever. So like understanding those two different feedback loops, but really prioritizing, you can do good building something really important, really critical. I think it's Clayton Christensen talks about that whole, like, how are you going to measure your life? You know, you have to optimize for both, because one will give you quick feedback and the other will give you much more enjoyment in the long term, but much slower feedback. You know, your six-year-old doesn't give you good feedback on a lot of the things you do.
No. I was going to say, we were joking before about reading Pete the Cat to our children last night. And I mean, I got no thank you, mommy, for reading me Pete the Cat. But at the end of the day, when it comes down to it, someday he will remember reading books every night before he went to bed. And he will remember the time that I took and that my phone was put away. And I think in this current world, that's really significant.
Right. And you never know, too, the moments that they remember that will kind of be the defining moments of their childhood. So
yes.
Just to wrap up, what advice, you've gone through your whole journey that's, you know, had its ups and downs with starting your nonprofit, but what advice would you give listeners to go and take action on listening to this episode? We like to, you know, kind of leave our listeners with one final thought on what they can do, how they can take action. What would that be from you, Chelsea?
I think for me, kind of going back to a few things that I've said, one, read, and research. Don't assume that because you saw one idea and you thought it was great, that that is the only idea or that it's the best, and have the humility to recognize that something may prove you wrong. So I think that's been something that's been significant in our journey all along, is that I'm constantly reading and constantly researching. And reading may not be that I was reading a book about something, but I might be reading juvenile code for courts because I want to be the most informed in my field. That would be one piece of advice. The second piece of advice would be to find trusted people from all different walks of life. Tell them your idea. Tell them, ask them whether they think it would work, and then ask them to give you at least three things that could fall apart in your idea. And I think with that, what you're going to go back and say is, okay, this wasn't unsolicited advice. This was solicited advice. So first of all, you're not going to be offended by somebody shooting holes in your idea. But secondly, you look at those, put them up on a whiteboard or on a piece of paper, and then figure out, if that's the case, what's my plan B and what's my plan C? And I think that that's really significant. And when I talk about different walks of life, I also think it's significant when you're asking these people, don't just ask successful business people. Ask people who are going to be your clients. Ask people who know you and know what you want for your family and your organization, that's going to create your organization with a culture that reflects your own values. The first couple people that I told my idea to, one was my son's biological grandmother, who is very close to me. We still talk all the time. But I said to her, is this going to work? What do you think? Does this actually create dignity? Would you ever want to be a part of this? How would this have changed your family? Why would people not come to this? So asking her all these questions, but really inviting the people that you're looking to serve, or whoever that client may be, asking them whether or not this actually is a good idea, rather than you just telling people it's a good idea. So finding all different people, people who knew nothing about foster care. And so what was great is they'd say, I don't know about foster care. And I'd be like, that's great, because I'm going to tell you about some business ideas. And I need you to tell me whether this structure actually works. So I would say looking for people who are able to tell you those things, and then taking that critical feedback, is really, really important. And then always being able to look at that feedback through the values that are most important to you. Like I said earlier, if your values, your personal values, are not connected to your mission, you're not going to make it past the 3-5 years. You may not make it past year one, because it's really, really, really hard. And the value system that you hold is what keeps you going. At Foster Care Alliance, now Mothers Advocacy Project, our values are family, dignity, and generosity. Everything we do is done through those lenses. We ask our staff that on their staff reviews. We ask that of our clients in their satisfaction reviews. We want to make sure that every person that walks through our doors, we've even asked donors this, do they see these values in everything that we do? So if you don't even know what your values are yet, then you're probably not even ready yet to start sharing your vision.
That's such great advice, Chelsea. And I just want to say thank you for being on the show. And this is just a tremendous episode. I think people will get a lot out of it. Where can listeners find out more about you and the Mothers Advocacy Project?
Yeah. So you can go to our website, mothersadvocacyproject.org, and you can find information there. We also do have a Facebook page and an Instagram, which is Mothers Advocacy Project, and you can connect with us in that way. We do send out quarterly newsletters, ways to get involved, those types of things. And so we would love for you to be a part of that. And we hope by the end of this year to have actually some training on trauma and to learn more, to be ready by the end of this year, start to launch some of the teaching that we do around our work. And so if you stay connected with us, there will even be opportunities to learn more.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Chelsea, for being on the show. This has been a real pleasure, and good luck with the next year. And hopefully it's a little less ups and downs of the last few. So good luck.
Yes, I hope so, but we'll make it regardless.
Right. I have no doubt. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you're interested in our upcoming workshop, visit our website at sevenfigurefundraising.com. We conduct these workshops twice a year in March and September, and we've broken these workshops up so you can take them live online with 6 2-hour courses spread over 3 weeks. We'll send you a workbook and other class materials to make it really easy for you to follow along. In fact, this is what one of our students, Austin, said about his experience in our workshop.
Hi, my name is Austin Brooks. I'm an executive director of a nonprofit called Midland Institute for Entrepreneurship. I took Seven-Figure Fundraising 18 months ago. And since that course, two things I want to share. One is the results. Two is what I didn't expect. And the results as a nonprofit, even though we reach into 10 states, even though we're working in 320 high schools, we've always had a pretty small donor base. And what's been so powerful in the results that we've seen since this course is I've successfully been able to recruit and add some new donors that had never previously been given to our organization. And then more importantly, there's this idea that's gonna be shared in this course called the Dynamic Dozen. You have to take the course to figure out what it's about. But within our Dynamic Dozen, we had 5 donors increase their giving in a big way. And between that and the new donors, this has been a game changer for our growing nonprofit. But the second thing that I really took away that really matters is just the mindset shift. What I wasn't expecting was how much my mindset needed to shift, how much I had to just shift my poverty thinking or my scarcity mindset to realizing that whether there's a recession, whether we lose a couple donors, if your organization is doing good work, more people need to know about it. And so the confidence that I gained in terms of talking to high-level individuals who believe in our mission has just grown. And what's been more impressive than anything is the proof has been in the actual donors we've gained. So if I can do this, I believe you can. You can't miss this course. You got to take it.
If you're interested in attending, visit sevenfigurefundraising.com. We hope to see you there. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, please take 60 seconds to leave a review. Thanks a lot, and good luck with your fundraising.